This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Americans made more money last month.
So why aren't we spending it?
Marketplace Midday Update is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Bob Moon in for Jeremy Hobson. Thanks for downloading our podcast from Marketplace.org. It's Monday, February 28th. Coming up, what can $4 billion worth of budget cuts buy Uncle Sam? Time. In a revolution, dictators can fall, and so can money from tourism.
And later, selling Girl Scout cookies on sidewalks in Savannah? Not anymore.
Oh.
Yeah. Those stories straight ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
We start this morning with the latest economic indicators. The biggest jump in personal income in nearly 2 years last month didn't put American consumers in a spending mood. That's the word today from the Commerce Department, which reports personal incomes jumped a percentage point in January.
But consumers only bumped up their spending a meager 0.2%. To help us sort this all out, let's turn to Julia Coronado. She's senior U.S. economist at BNP Paribas in New York. Good morning, and let's start with why there wasn't more spending last month when we had money in our wallets. That was thanks to a tax cut, as I understand it?
Right. The jump in income came from the payroll tax holiday that got put in place in January. And what the report tells us is that consumers are actually pretty prudent and cautious. They saved a lot of that increase in take-home pay.
Now, these numbers reflect what was happening before energy prices really took off. Are there any clues in these numbers of how resistant the economy might be to another gasoline price shock?
Well, I think some of the cooling in consumer spending does reflect that. Consumers have been facing higher food and energy prices for the last few months, and as you note, they're looking forward to even further increases in the months ahead. So they're starting to become a little bit more cautious. They loosened up their wallets a little bit for the holidays, but now they seem to be pulling back a bit and starting the year on a cautious note.
Very quickly, there's a headline in the New York Times this morning suggesting easier credit is behind a rise in auto sales. That's good news, yes?
It is good news. It's good news that consumers who want and can afford cars can actually get them financed. I don't think that's necessarily, given how cautious consumers are, going to lead to a huge surge. But it does say that consumers, again, who are interested can find the financing, and that certainly is a welcome development.
Julia Coronado is senior U.S. economist at BNP Paribas in New York. Thanks for your insights.
My pleasure.
Now to the budget battle in Washington. Congress may use a short-term funding bill to keep the government open through mid-March. And in the meantime, House members will work on a larger budget bill. That's $4 billion in budget cuts agreed upon will buy time. But there's something much more complex behind the deal. From Washington, here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer.
This latest stopgap bill would cut $4 billion, mainly from programs that President Obama has already proposed cutting, including a reading program and state election funding. The short-term bill would also eliminate almost $3 billion in earmarks, those spending requests for special projects in congressional districts. Republicans and Democrats are still wrangling over spending. House Speaker John Boehner says the spending squabble doesn't have to cause a government shutdown.
We have a moral responsibility to address the problems that we face. And that means working together to cut spending and to rein in government, not shutting it down.
Congress never did manage to hammer out a budget bill for this year. The two-week stopgap bill would allow more negotiations on a spending measure to fund the government through September 30th, the end of the government's budget year. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Libya's leader Muammar Gaddafi continues hanging on to power as unrest goes on now for a third week. And after the UN Security Council passed a resolution over the weekend ordering an arms embargo and freezing Gaddafi's assets.
In Egypt today, the top prosecutor ordered the assets of that country's ousted president, Hosni Mubarak, to also be frozen. You could say Egypt was Libya 1 month ago, and the unrest in Egypt sent hundreds of thousands of tourists away from that country. That's taken a mighty toll on the streets. From Cairo, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
An old man in long robes and a turban plays the rabab, a little Egyptian stringed instrument. He hawks the rababs to tourists on a bridge over the Nile. But he's got no audience, and the commercial odds are against him. Way more sellers than buyers. Eric Bonmasson is a 22-year-old architecture student visiting from France. A few days ago, he went to the Great Pyramids at Giza.
We were nearly the only tourists, so we had all the pyramids for ourselves.
Magda Candel of the Egyptian Center for Economic Studies says without much oil and with 7,000 years of history to market, Egypt is uniquely dependent on tourist dollars, not to mention euros and yen. They support 5 million jobs, 20% of the economy. Candel says the tourism sector needs stability and for the tanks to come off the streets. Problem is, with Libya next door, this is an increasingly tough tourism neighborhood.
The biggest effect of the crisis on Egypt from an economic point of view is the loss of tourism income, which is estimated over $1 billion a year.
Egyptians are working hard to lure tourists back.
They're going to view this, I don't want to be on a plane crossing the Atlantic or crossing the Mediterranean to go to Egypt.
A group of young people who participated in the revolution decided to print their own ID cards and stamp them National Museum Youth. Now they're painting the cast iron grillwork outside the Egyptian Museum.
We paint gates and pavements and we sweep the floors and the ground.
Why are you painting here?
To make our museum beautiful and regain its rank among people again.
And at last Friday's rally in Tahrir Square, as people sang the national anthem, a man held a sign reading, "Tourism, now better. Come to Egypt. World spot amended." The English isn't great, but the sentiment's clear. This is a new Egypt. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The price of oil is up about a dollar in trading today, and gas prices are up to an average of $3.29 a gallon. And this is the cheaper time of year for gas, right? Well, in some places, like California, the price is up to $4 or more. And Marketplace's Eve Tro reports that's the tipping point for some consumers.
People take round numbers more seriously. Think of the four-minute mile or your 40th birthday. Economist Greg Daco says gas prices are the same. When fuel hits $4 a gallon,
consumer confidence drops more than it would just according to rising gasoline prices.
And nervous consumers will spend less on other goods and services.
So there's a bit of a substitution effect that goes on there.
If those high prices stick around, gas sales go down as people reconsider how much they drive or even what they drive. Sam Jaffe is with IDC Energy. He says $4 gas changed the car market in summer 2008.
Prius sales went out the roof. That psychological barrier has a huge impact on the car buying decision.
This time around, more companies have hybrid and electric cars ready. But remember, in summer 2008, more people had jobs. It could take prices closer to the big $5 a gallon to spur sales today. In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
HSBC Bank said today pre-tax profits for last year doubled over 2009, but those numbers were less than what analysts were expecting. New Zealand's prime minister said the devastating earthquake in Christchurch could cost the country $15 billion.
We've got more numbers, stocks, and a lot of other numbers as well. You can check out the numbers section at our website, marketplace.org. You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, February 28th, the last day of the month. I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Bob Moon. Now more of the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics at the intersection of the U.S. and the rest of the world. The world's largest retailer has abandoned Russia. Walmart never opened an actual store there, but it did open an office in Moscow with public plans to expand. Reporter Peter Van Dyke has more.
Russia is one of the fastest-growing retail markets in the world. But for many U.S. companies, it's hard to start fresh here. Instead, multinationals buy an existing local company and grow it. PepsiCo just spent billions of dollars to buy the largest Russian milk and juice producer. That's what Walmart wanted to do, but Kopeka, a chain named after the Russian word for penny, was just sold to a local competitor instead. Natalia Zvagozdina is an investment banker at Renaissance Capital.
And I think they realize that organically the next 2 years will not offer them a lot of opportunity to open. They just have nothing to buy.
In a few years, she says, Walmart will probably be back. Russia is just growing too fast. After all, Walmart has successfully broken into the other big emerging markets of Brazil, India and China. For now, though, Russia is a brick too far. In Moscow, I'm Peter Van Dyke for Marketplace.
Groupon couldn't resist the lure of the world's fastest-growing market, China. Well, today the Daily Deal website goes live in China. Ask locals and they'll tell you that people will embrace the Groupon idea of group buying. The question is whether Groupon will be able to rise above the fray. The BBC's Chris Hogg reports from Hong Kong.
Chinese shoppers love a bargain. In stores, they'll always ask for a discount. And because online prices are often lower than those in the shops, internet retail sales almost doubled in China last year. Groupon will be hoping to cash in on that hunger for a good deal. Its group buying model works well in the US. Its new Chinese site will offer discounts on eating, shopping and entertainment in Shanghai and Beijing, and in time other Chinese cities. But retail analyst Paul French from Access Asia in Shanghai says it'll take Groupon a while to catch up the local Chinese firms which already offer similar schemes.
The most important thing is reach. You know, the days when you could just offer a service in Shanghai and Beijing and a handful of other cities are gone. There's 160 cities in China with more than a million people in them, and we need to get coupons into all of those cities.
China has the world's largest internet market. That's a lot of potential customers. But other American firms like Best Buy have found what works in the States doesn't always work with shoppers here. In Hong Kong, I'm the BBC's Chris Hogg for Marketplace.
How many times, Steve, have you seen the driver in the car next to you texting?
Oh, my gosh.
A lot, I would assume.
Many times, absolutely.
Or you've moved out of the way to keep from walking into some clueless cell phone user.
Or bumped into him on purpose.
Yeah, maybe. There's a new survey out that doesn't offer much hope here. It was sponsored by Intel. 90% surveyed say they've witnessed cell phone rudeness firsthand at a frequency of almost 5 offenses every day.
Oh, my goodness.
And almost half saw people using one in a restroom. And 1 in 5 said they saw people using the gadgets on a honeymoon.
On a honeymoon.
Now, I don't know, but if you're paying more attention to a cell phone on your honeymoon, I'd suggest you got much bigger issues than just an etiquette problem.
What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Monday, February 28th. I'm Bob Moon.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis, also known as Radio Chio on Twitter.
Mm-hmm. City leaders in New York City say the Big Apple needs to get more money in its coffers, just as budget stalemates and crises continue in other cities and states. Think Wisconsin, think Detroit. Well, New York's thinking about parking meters and sewage to put back the bulge in its purse. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
Last year, New York took in more than $140 million from parking meters like this one. Now the city is looking to partner with private companies to figure out how to earn more money from meters, parking garages, and other services. To plug its $5 billion budget gap, New York is also trying to find a fertilizer company to buy its sewage. Kent Smetters is a municipal budget expert at the Wharton School. He says these are the right approaches.
Trying to partner with private sector in order to improve operations, reduce costs. That's a true economic efficiency that's a win-win for both sides.
For instance, New York parking meters don't work about 10% of the time. Fixing that could bring in a lot of quarters. Smetter says it's a better tactic than what a lot of cities are trying, selling municipal buildings and other assets for a quick chunk of money. Chicago leased out the next 75 years' worth of parking meter revenues for $1 billion and will end up sacrificing an estimated $10 billion in revenue in the long run. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
At the Oscars last night in Hollywood, The King's Speech took home the Best Picture trophy and three others, including for lead actor Colin Firth. Well, back home in Britain, before that movie was made, the idea didn't get a lot of funding bites and relied in part on money from a government program to grow the film industry in the UK. But as the British government trims spending now, that program has been put on the chopping block. Christopher Worth is with us now from London with the latest. Good morning, Christopher.
Good morning.
Are film buffs in the UK celebrating this?
Yes, they are. This is a film that costs about $13 million and will most likely go over $300 million at the box office. But at the same time, the British are mourning the loss of the British, the public body that was brave enough to invest in the movie back when the others didn't want to. Because the budget cuts, the UK Film Council will be no more in just another month's time. I spoke with Angus Finney at the Cass Business School.
Frankly, axing the UK Film Council, which ironically has now coincided with a mega hit, does make the government look pretty foolish.
Are there any plans, Christopher, to use the success of the film as a way to, I don't know, get the funding back?
Well, the UK Film Council could make close to $20 million on its investment. I mean, that money will now go to the British Film Institute, which is now responsible for investing in films. But the other irony is the cost of winding down the Film Council is estimated at about $20 million.
Huh. All right. Christopher Worth in London. Christopher, thanks.
Hey, thanks, Steve.
Well, the Oscars have taken place for nearly a decade at the Kodak Theater in the center of Hollywood. The complex that includes that theater was partly paid for by public money. Now, though, a $25 billion hole in California's budget means that stream of public money may soon end. Here's Marketplace's Jennifer Collins.
The Kodak Theater is the gilded center of the Hollywood and Highland complex. There's also a high-end hotel, a fountain, and a four-story mall. Local resident Marion Gore says she comes here as little as possible.
It's really not user-friendly, not on any level, not for shopping, not for, you know, events that I've come to.
Hollywood and Highland is one of thousands of projects in California, partly paid for by community redevelopment agencies. The state agencies help finance projects through bonds and then use a share of the property taxes to pay off debt. For Hollywood and Highland, the agency kicked in nearly $100 million of the more than $600 million it costs to build the place. Then, 3 years after it opened, the developer sold the complex at a huge loss. And that was before the real estate market collapsed. Bob Blue is with a Hollywood preservation organization.
By any stretch of the imagination, it was a financial failure.
But the complex did help attract tourists and shops to the area, which also includes the Hollywood Walk of Fame, Grauman's Chinese Theater, and Madame Tussauds Wax Museum. Madeline Janis is on the board of the L.A. Redevelopment Agency.
You go to hotel owners in Hollywood, and they'll say, thank God for the Hollywood and Highland Project. It helped us bring our business back.
Dozens of states use redevelopment programs to finance similar projects. But now, California Governor Jerry Brown says his state's agencies should be shut down. They locked down as much as $5 billion in taxes that could be put toward education and other programs. Stephen Frates teaches public policy at Pepperdine University.
There's no question that it is distorted development. And in terms of distorting cash flows of government, you can make a strong argument that its time has passed.
California lawmakers are still debating whether the state should roll up the red carpet on projects like Hollywood and Highland, and other states will be watching. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
And finally, it is Girl Scout cookie season again. You know this, right, Bob?
Mm-hmm.
You've probably seen the pages and pages of all the delightful cookies you can buy from your coworkers or your family members. Absolutely. Well, this year, there's one place in Savannah, Georgia. You're not going to be able to buy your Do-Si-Dos or your Thin Mints or Tagalongs,
mm-hmm,
right?
Well,
some of my favorites. Mm-hmm. On the street, the city last year put the kibosh on selling cookies on public sidewalks because that would violate a selling things on sidewalks ordinance. That ordinance includes the sidewalk in front of the historic Juliet Lowe House in Savannah.
Who is?
Yeah. Juliet Lowe was the founder of the Girl Scouts.
No cookies there?
No cookies there either.
Oh,
and people there say they bring in like tons of people and they sell a bunch of cookies every day and no cookies there.
I'll take Samoas.
Oh, you like the Samoas too. Yeah, tag alongs. I think the Thin Mints are my favorites. I'm not sure.
Why do they call them Thin Mints though?
I don't know because they're not thin. Yeah, you know, you get fat eating the Thin Mints.
Yeah.
Exactly. I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Bob Moon. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.